In this podcast, we talk about topics such as rape and sexual abuse. Good morning, everybody. It's Emily here from the Willow Pod, and we've got Lorna from SV2 with us again. Hi, Lorna.
Morning.
So today we are talking about consent. So I've heard the kids talking about consent, but what do you actually mean by consent?
Yeah, so from SV2's perspective, what we're talking about is sexual consent. So legally, Section 74 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003 defines consent as a person agrees by choice and has the freedom and capacity to make that choice. So there's a couple of things really that we need to think about. So the first thing that can affect capacity is the one that everyone thinks about, which is age. As I'm sure everyone knows, the legal age of consent in the UK is 16. Yep. That's for everyone, all genders and both same sex and opposite sex relationships. So it doesn't make any difference. It's 16. But there are some other ages to be aware of when we're talking about consent. So the first one is 13. So what's important to know is the law is not necessarily there to prosecute two 15-year-olds who are having sex. But it is very clear that anyone under the age of 13 cannot consent, no matter what. So there's no grey area at all. Anybody under the age of 13 is not old enough to consent, right. Regardless of the kind of age of partners and things. So that's the first one to be aware of. The other age to be aware of is 18. So that's an interesting one because it's relevant depending on the relationship between the parties. And basically, it's about positions of trust. So, for example, if a teacher has a relationship with a 17-year-old student, that's illegal. The student has to be 18.
Right.
And it doesn't just apply to teachers. It can be anybody that's in the position of trust over the young person. So sports coaches, scout leaders, you know, anyone that's in a position of trust.
Yeah.
And in those cases, the legal age of consent raises to 18.
Right.
So they're the kind of age-wise, they're the things we think about when it comes to consent. But there are other things, and that's where the freedom and choice comes into it. But also there's things like being under the influence. So that could be drugs or alcohol. If you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol, you're not able to give consent. But yeah. It's important to know that's not just illegal drugs. So there's quite a few prescription drugs where that would reduce someone's capacity. So yeah, it's kind of important to be. I'm not talking about, you know, typical over the counter or even most prescription medications, but there are some that would reduce people's capacity to consent.
Right.
The other ones are being unconscious or asleep. Obviously, you can't consent if you're unconscious or you're asleep.
Right.
Which is probably doesn't need any explanation.
Well, you'd think not, but yeah.
So you have to be kind of conscious and awake. But the other one to be aware of is also some mental health disorders or illnesses, which means they're unable to make an informed choice. So there are certain conditions that mean people aren't able to make that kind of informed choice about giving consent.
Right.
So that's the first part. And then we need to look a little bit more about things that can affect choice and freedom. So being pressured or blackmailed, being scared or being coerced, or even feeling guilty. Mm. So any of those kind of feelings mean people aren't giving a free choice there to consent to, you know, any kind of sexual contact. So we're not just talking about full intercourse, any kind of sexual contact. You have to be able to make a choice and have the freedom to make that choice.
So yeah,
it's a lot more to unpack than just being over 16. So yeah, they're the kind of legalities around what consent looks like. But it is important to remember that consent doesn't have to be verbal. People give physical cues when you talk to kind of body language experts and things. I think it's a really high percentage of how we communicate is not verbal.
Yeah.
So it is important that you've got to be aware of your partner's actions as well as words, because actually if somebody says yes because they feel pressured, but their body language is clearly saying no.
No, yeah, got you.
But it is important that people are kind of aware of that as well. There is an acronym. We love an acronym.
you seem to have a new acronym every time I talk to you.
I realise I do. I'm sorry. But I'll tell you what it means. So it's a weird one. The acronym is FRIES, and you hear it a lot around consent. But what it stands for is consent must be freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic and specific. So it isn't, you know, people can consent to some parts, but they don't have to consent to everything. Right. And you can withdraw consent as well. So that's where reversible comes into it. So just because you said yes doesn't mean it has to stay yes.
It is a lot more complicated than I thought, isn't it? So what sort of age should we be talking to young people about consent? When should we start bringing it up into conversation so they understand as well?
Yeah, all ages, everyone, all the time.
Okay.
Obviously in an age-appropriate way.
Yeah.
But it's never too young to start having those conversations. There's loads of information around consent and resources available for children of all ages. And we should be talking to everyone, boys and girls, all genders, all ages, about consent. Some schools, you'll see, will start to touch on it from a very young age. Obviously not in regards to kind of sexual consent.
No.
But around things like respect and body boundaries. So the earlier these ideas are introduced, the better. But it's important to say that even if schools are having those conversations, parents, carers, anyone supporting young people can also be talking to the young people about it at home or in the settings that they support them.
Yeah.
It's such a great way to giving your children like the confidence to say no and establishing their own boundaries about what they feel comfortable with. And again, that's not just around sexual consent, but all kinds of consent. So body boundaries, things like that are such a first stepping stone towards those things around consent. And they can form part of your everyday life with your children and young people.
Yeah.
So as a child gets older, the conversation might be around healthy relationships and sexual consent. And again, there's loads of stuff out there to support with those conversations. So most people have probably seen or heard of the tea video.
Yes, yes.
Which is one that a lot of schools use. It's really, really common for explaining sexual consent. So common that I think a lot of people are like, not this again.
I always want a cup of tea.
Yeah. And it's a really good one. There are some kind of concerns with it around people with neurodiversities or autism that might struggle with that one. But there are loads of others out there which are really good. And you'll find loads of books available on the topic of consent for all ages. So this isn't endorsed by SV2, I'll say. But from my personal perspective, I've got a great book for my 4-year-old son, which is called Consent, Respect and Body Boundaries. So yeah, so it starts from such a young age. And this is one that personally, not SV2 recommendation, but my personal recommendation is a really, really good one because it talks about being able to say no to if people want to hug or to hold hands or you don't feel comfortable, whether that's other children or grown up. So it's a really good one. And there are loads. That's not the only one. There are loads out there that are really good.
You know, like you say about having a book to talk about it. My youngest one's 13 and I don't think there were books like that around or not readily available, shall I say.
No, I think the use of the internet is a brilliant tool. I'm sure you can order things to your local bookshops, but it's such a wider world in regards to resources. And there are a lot of organisations. So I know NSPCC have got some stuff around consent and obviously we do the workshops. So we offer consent workshops to schools, colleges, universities, youth groups, anybody over the age of 13, we're commissioned to deliver that training to, which kind of covers what the law is around sexual consent, what it looks like, some of the stuff we've just talked around, and also the basics around sexual abuse as well. But also we can support teachers in delivering sessions to younger groups. So if there are teachers that want to deliver sessions to younger age groups, we can deliver training to them and support them to deliver sessions in an age appropriate way. So, yeah, there are services that deliver those sessions, but there also is loads of material if people particularly want to look into starting to talk to their children or young people they support around consent.
So I think you've got a little quiz for me, haven't you, to check I've been listening.
I have. It's not all stuff I've covered as well. So this might be a little bit, there's a little bit in here around common myths as well. So.
Oh, and I'm very competitive. So.
Oh, right. Okay. And there's only a few questions, but the first one is most rapes are committed by someone known.
Oh, yes. And that's definitely true. That's
yes,
true.
100%. You are right. Partners, ex-partners and associates make up the majority of perpetrators. And that's an interesting fact as well, because there is, with a younger age group, becomes more likely to be associates. So that 16 to 24 student age, most assaults are committed by somebody known to them, but not partner or an ex-partner. So
yeah,
just an associate. So it does change slightly with age groups, but yeah, 100%. It's not true that you're more likely to be attacked by a stranger. It's almost always somebody that's known to the victim. Okay, question number two. If you wear a skirt and are sexually assaulted, it is your fault.
Well, I know the answer is no. So I'm 42 and I was constantly told by my elders, shall we say, when I was younger. So I reckon if you ask the generation above me, they would say, yes, it is your fault for wearing a short skirt. But I know it isn't. It isn't anyone's fault. It's not to do with what they're wearing.
100%. Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's false. There's still a level of blame in when it comes to sexual assault. So it's never, ever the victim's fault, regardless of the circumstances. But it is one of the most prevalent myths around sexual assault, that what you're wearing plays a part. And actually, there's a few years ago, I don't know if you've heard of this, there was an art exhibit called What I Was Wearing. I think the lady's name was Mary Simmerling, but I might be wrong, so I apologise in advance if I am. But essentially, the aim of the exhibit was to challenge the idea that provocative clothing is the cause of sexual assault. So they displayed, I think it was around 40 outfits of what different people were wearing when they were assaulted, just to show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really hard hitting, but it really does dispel that victim blaming myth that clothing has anything to do with sexual assault. So you can still probably see pictures of it online and stuff. It's worth having a look at.
Yeah, I'm going
to
look
hard hitting.
I'm going to look that up after we've finished.
Yeah. So yes, you are 100% right. It's never the victim's fault, regardless of any circumstances. Okay, this one is about consent. Question number three. If you're drunk, you can't give consent.
I'm just trying to remember what you said. If you're drunk, so your thinking is impaired. So no, you can't give consent.
Yeah, that's true. So we've spoken about capacity to give consent already. And yes, absolutely. If you are drunk, you don't have that capacity. So yeah, that's true.
Three out of three. I'm doing well.
You are. Okay, question number four. People often lie and say they've been raped after regretful sex.
I want to say no, but I bet some people must do. Some people must say it. It's rape after they've decided that that they didn't want to.
It's actually false. You were doing so well. Studies have suggested that actually only 4% of incidents reported to the police are found to be false. And when you consider how many instances of sexual assault and rape are reported to the police.
Oh, yeah.
It's a tiny, tiny number. So this is one that we see quite a lot popping up in the incel movement, which I don't know if your listeners will be aware of the incel movement. Incels are involuntary celibates. It started, I think, primarily in America, but we've seen it worldwide, of this movement of predominantly men who have a very negative connotation around females and sex. And there is this myth, particularly in that movement, but it has spread wider than that, that women will often lie or make false rape allegations. And it's really dangerous because we know that that's just not true.
No.
But it does put this negative spin on genuine allegations.
On reporting rape, yeah.
Absolutely. And it may mean that people that have been raped, whether they're women or men, are less likely to report because there is a fear that people will think that they're lying.
Yeah. I have heard of incels. So I'm hoping actually we're going to do some podcasts about incels in the new year.
Oh, so brilliant.
Maybe you could come along and join us for one of those.
Yeah, more than happy to. It's something that we need to be very aware of because actually it's a very, very dangerous movement.
Yes, very, very. I think, is it regarded as a form of terrorism? A hate crime?
Yeah, it's a weird one because they've never, no incel, as far as I'm aware, has ever been charged with terrorism. But actually, if you look at the definition of terrorism, it fits.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes, I find the whole incel thing very interesting. Odd, but interesting.
It's definitely something that is getting to a stage where it's worrying. And it goes hand in hand with misogyny and all the stuff that young people, particularly, I guess, women and, you know, and some men are having to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Oh, another delightful topic for us to talk about in the future.
Yeah. One day I'll come on and talk about something really positive.
Fluffy bunnies. We'll review some crazy cat videos, YouTube videos.
That'd be lovely. But yeah, at least I've come on and talked about support services. So that's positive, although it's, you know, sad that it's needed.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Question. Right. I've got two more. Boys and men don't get raped.
I'm going to say they do get raped. They do get raped.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a particular barrier around men. And I know I've been on and spoken about male victims before.
Yeah.
But stats show that 1 in 6 men have had unwanted sexual experiences. So it's actually really prevalent that men will experience sexual assault, rape, but are far less likely to access support for it.
Yeah.
So it's something that we need to kind of tackle. And we do have a little section on SVT's website around male myths.
Yeah.
Because they are so predominant in society that people still have these misconceptions around men and boys that have been victimized. But yeah, absolutely. Men and boys can be raped,
right,
just like women. Last question.
Right.
Going to someone's house does not mean yes to sex. True or false?
Going to someone's house does not mean yes to sex. That's true.
100% that is true. And this is very similar to the what you're wearing myth.
Yeah.
That actually going to someone's house is not consenting to sex. Going home with somebody from a night out does not mean yes to sex. Letting somebody into your house in the early hours of the morning does not mean yes to sex. But they are unfortunately rape myths that people still encounter, that we still think that if you've gone out on a night out and gone home with somebody that you deserve to be sexually assaulted, which is absolutely
ridiculous.
Not true. It's ridiculous.
No.
But we do have this level of victim blaming. So it's just really important to be aware that consent plays such a part in it. And actually, whatever actions you take, you know, whatever the circumstances, it's never the victim's fault, and it's never giving somebody the right to assault somebody if they're not consenting. So yes, that's the end of my quiz.
So 5 out of 6.
You did really well.
Yes. Well, it's all these podcasts I've been doing with you, Lorna. I'm obviously picking something up. I hope people played along at home, and I hope they got 6 out of 6. But the thing to remember is it's never a victim's fault.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. It is more complex than yes or no. So, yeah, it's something to be aware of. And obviously, as we've said, something that everybody needs to kind of talk to their young people, talk to their children about. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm just thinking, we went out for a coffee to talk about more delightful things, didn't we, a few weeks ago? And you told me that some huge number of 13-year-olds had seen or shared explicit photos. And I was horrified because my two younger kids are between 13 and 14. So I went home and I scared them to death, I have to say, because I asked them if they had seen or sent explicit photos, and they were both horrified with me. So where does consent come into the sharing of photos? Because so many young people have got mobile phones and they're all on WhatsApp groups. So, yeah, where does the sharing of photos come into that?
Yeah, so when it comes to kind of sharing sexual images, the law changes a little bit. So the legal age to send or receive images is 18.
Crikey, so older than the age of consent.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit of a strange one, but it's because it falls under the Protection of Children Act rather than the Sexual Offences Act.
Right.
So, yeah, theoretically, anybody sending or receiving images of children under the age of 18 could be charged with making or distributing indecent images of children. So it falls under the pornography legislation rather than the sexual offences legislation, if that makes sense.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it is a strange one. And I know when I've spoken to young people about it, they're always quite taken aback because, as you've said, it's higher than the age of consent.
Mm.
It's not uncommon. Absolutely, it's not uncommon. So we know that sharing intimate images with partners is not uncommon. And between consenting adults, it's not illegal.
No.
However, we're also aware that the abuse of intimate images is really common. So you'll see people call it revenge porn. That's what it's commonly kind of known as in the media and things. But it is illegal. It can happen online or offline in more traditional methods. So email, text messages. But it's really important that when we're talking about revenge porn, it's worth noting that the victim has done nothing wrong. So actually, a lot of services are moving away from that term because it implies that there's something to take revenge for.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So yeah, it's not revenge. It's abuse is what it is. Yeah. So we kind of prefer the term intimate image abuse. You'll see agencies refer to intimate image abuse or image-based abuse or, you know, things around that. So yeah, so that's why we've moved away from that term. So that's where it becomes illegal. The law around sharing of images, at the moment, it's about proving the intent to cause harm. I mean, you'd be charged for that. But actually, that's changing. So there's a new offence. It's called the Online Safety Bill, which has just received royal assent. So it will be coming into law very, very shortly, although I don't know exactly when. But it changes the legislation a little bit. And what it does is remove the need to prove intent to cause harm. So that is brilliant for people that have been victims of having their images shared either online or, you know, amongst peers or anything. Yeah. Because actually proving intent to cause harm is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
How is that proved? So removing that need is actually brilliant for victims because it actually will protect them from when their images have been shared. The police have far more powers to do something about it, which is great. The other thing it's including, which is quite interesting, and I'm a little bit technical, but not very technical, but they're including deepfake and AI generated images in the legislation.
I was just thinking about that when you were saying that, where they superimpose someone's face onto, you know, someone's body that's engaging in a sexual act.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's essentially what deepfake is. So they could take an image that's pornography or anything really and put victim's face on that image. So from the outside, it looks like that's that person engaging in that act. Previously, that hasn't been illegal because technology advances much more quickly than the legislation does, unfortunately. But the Online Safety Bill does cover that. So people will be protected in that way because essentially, from that person's perspective, even if they know it's not them engaging in that act, nobody else will. So from the outside, it looks like them. So the law will protect people in that way as well, which is great. That's really a step forward to protecting victims of those types of offences. And there are loads of other organisations which specialise in supporting people that have been subject to those offences. So there's the Revenge Porn Helpline, which they appreciate the name is not the best name. I did some training with them a little while ago and they'd said that intimate image abuse is actually more accurate, but people know the term revenge porn, which is why they are called that. But that's a service you can Google that will support people in those types of offences. And there is some others as well that specialise in tools that services can offer to have images removed. So that essentially uses kind of facial recognition to search for that image online and then they can have it taken down. So there are lots of kind of organisations out there that can support people that have been subject to intimate image abuse. So definitely, if that's you, seek support. SV2 can support as well. So we'll offer the kind of same services that we offer it to any type of sexual abuse. So it doesn't matter to us if it's a contact offence or a non-contact, like an online offence, we will support. And we can also support people accessing those services that can do that kind of practical logistical stuff of working towards getting images taken down. The other online offence that's worth mentioning here that I haven't mentioned so far is sextortion.
Right.
This is another kind of mediary term. But perpetrators can use images as a method of blackmail. And what sextortion is blackmail. So essentially what happens is someone demands payment or threatens to share intimate images. So again, that can be online or it could be threats to send to family members, friends, work colleagues. And sextortion, it seems overwhelmingly, is kind of committed by criminal gangs. So they can target people through web chat, webcams, have them send images, posing to be somebody else, have them send intimate images over webcam or, you know, in image form, picture form. And then those threats, demands for payment, threats to share will happen, which can be really devastating. And there's been some quite high profile media reports of, unfortunately, people that have been victims of sextortion going on to end their lives. Oh. So it's a really terrible, terrible thing, and unfortunately quite prevalent. So that's something just to be aware of as well, that people, you know, can be victims of those types of offences. But again, there is support out there. So there is some guidance, again, just for support services websites that support those types of offences. So Revenge Porn Helpline, Internet Watch Foundation, services like that. There is some guidance. So if you unfortunately have been victims of those types of offences, please seek support. There is support. You do have options.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't feel that you've got nowhere to turn with any kind of sexual offence, but something just to be particularly aware of with the online stuff.
I'll make sure I put those helplines in, as well as your information, obviously, but I'll put those helpline numbers in the blurb that accompanies the podcast. Oh, gosh, the internet's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it?
It has, unfortunately. It's a wonderful thing and an amazing tool, but unfortunately, it does have a lot to answer for, and there are a lot of negative sides to the internet. Mm.
There are. So you spoke earlier on about the workshops that you do at SV2. How would a professional get in touch with you at SV2 if they, say, wanted you to come and do some of your workshops at school?
Yeah, you can email help@sv2.org.uk, or we do have a booking form on the website as well. So if you go to sv2.org.uk, go to help and support, and you'll find the form under community engagement and training.
Right. I'll try and make sure there's a link for that as well in the blurb for the podcast.
Thank
well,
you.
Yet again, Lorna, you've made me feel absolutely awful. What a wonderful way to start my week.
Oh, I'm sorry, Emily.
Like I said, I think we're going to have to do some kind of a review of cute puppy videos in the new year. Let's start off with something nice, please.
That sounds
please,
wonderful.
Lorna.
That sounds wonderful.
Oh, but no, seriously, I mean, this is such an important topic. It really is. And I've learned a lot from this podcast, and I hope our listeners have too.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Emily. I appreciate it.
It's been great talking to you. Thanks again, Lorna.
Thanks, Emily. Bye.